Coming up today, the UK police are replacing advertising on copyright infringing websites to alert users they're breaking the law. Plus, driverless cars are set to be legal on London roads in about a year, and Russia has lost, then regained, control of a lizard sex satellite, which, yes, is exactly as brilliant as it sounds. Plus, we take a deep dive into our bulging sack of listener feedback to hear your views on hacking North Korea, Google Glass, and Japanese genital festivals, amongst other things. And in our discussion topic, we'll take a deep chug from a can that contains news that your favourite websites may be performing experiments on you, and you had no idea. What taste will that chug leave in the back of our mouths? We'll find out soon. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to space lizards and the war on piracy. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
And we are sans Liv.
Aww.
She's on a very well-deserved holly break. Holly bags, as she calls
holly
it.
Holly bears.
Where's she gone, actually?
Holly
bag. Barcelona. Barcelona, she's gone. How nice.
Tapas.
Yes, indeed. But it's a good opportunity to promote the fact that we have a new magazine out. We do these magazines. It's like a print version of Wired.co.uk podcast.
I hear that.
I like to think.
It's true.
But it's worth noting, Jeremy, I think the product editor on the mag, was particularly excited because he got to get photographed a whole bunch of surfboards that were modelled after sea creatures, which
Whoa.
I've seen in a preview.
That is awesome.
It looks pretty amazing. He's also got this ATV. I didn't really know what one was, which is shipped over from the US in a group test of these crazy high-end off-road vehicles and things. There's a bike, like a push bike in there with two front wheels. It's pretty mad. Plus, there's the 100 hottest European startups, big fat education special, big feature about Destiny, which I'm very excited about, the game. I've already seen the feature, actually. And then the cover story is a big package about fashion tech and tech fashion and how tech is helping and disrupting fashion, or fashion's disrupting tech. Anyway, that's out on the Thursday that you're hearing this. If you're listening to this now, then it is on sale. It's on iPads and tablets and iPhones and things like that. So do check it out if any of those things sound interesting. And with that, it's time to cruise into the news. It's time to start with crime. The Police Intellectual Property Crime Unit, catchily known as PIPCU, has started to replace advertising on copyright infringing websites with official warnings telling the user that the site is under criminal investigation. Now, the sites in question are those that have been identified as hosting copyright infringing content and reported to PIPCU by rights holders. Officers from the unit evaluate the sites to verify that they are in fact infringing copyright and will contact the site owner to give them the opportunity to, quote, correct their behaviour, end quote, and operate legitimately.
Because everyone's going to listen to that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what if that fails? I hear you not ask, because this is a one-way production. Well, I'll answer anyway. If that fails, PIPCU can get the site taken down by contacting the domain registrar or replace the site's ads with scary warnings.
Ooh. So are they actually paying for these warnings to go up? Surely not.
No. These are just replacing the ads. It's part of the problem is that there are ads bought by legitimate companies that go to ad networks, and the ad networks then, when their adverts are displayed on these illegitimate sites, kind of look like they're sponsoring copyright infringing websites, which a lot of them obviously don't want. So the police have partnered with a content verification company called Project Sunblock, which maintains a list of infringing websites and then makes sure that when those clients, those advertisers, advertisements are being delivered to those sites, they are instead given these alternative, be warned, you're browsing illegal material, ads from the police instead. And apparently there was a pilot last year, which I didn't know about until we published a story, and ads from these brands and things went down by 12%. So it does work.
Really? Whether it... I was going to say, nobody looks at these adverts. Come on.
Well, this is the thing. If you've ever been on any of these sites, the adverts are pretty bloody awful.
Yeah,
it's pop-ups and it's, you know, data grandma stuff. It's really not particularly pleasant advertising anyway. But apparently it went down 12%, and but we've no idea if it actually helps divert people to legitimate sources of content or not. But at least the advertisers are happy, which is a goal of this, I hear.
Jolly good.
Yes. So if you've seen any of these, by all means, let us know what you think to the design. We had a picture of one on our website. It did kind of actually look the way that our image thing is laid out, like our website was an illegal website, which, although it might be blocked in schools because we talk about sex and porn and severed, you know, and illegal whatnot, but all controversial such and such. I mean, it's rife for blocking, but
all in the sake of education, educating the kids.
Liat, how many lords were leaping in that Christmas song?
Gosh.
Nine?
12?
12 Lords are Leaping?
12 Lords are Leaping.
I never got that far, guys.
Well, they've leapt into our news today, regardless of how many are famous during Christmas time.
They are prancing angrily.
They are. They are very angry because the right to be forgotten laws, rules and things, which you've heard a lot about recently, is wrong, unworkable and unreasonable.
Hells yeah.
Liat of Clark, please do explain.
Just to recap, the right to be forgotten relates to the 1995 European Data Directive, and it basically means that everyone has the right to challenge the accessibility of online information about themselves or others if they think it's incomplete or irrelevant. It basically gives them the option to wipe the slate clean, digitally speaking. Now, you know, Google was pretty annoyed about this. They did not want to do it because the burden's fallen on them, the biggest search engine in the world, to remove these links anytime anyone complains about it. So the law came into effect earlier this year. Google's whinged about it, but kind of gotten on with it in a very kind of arbitrary manner. Now the Lords are saying no to this law. They're saying no, Europe, once again. We don't like this law. We're not okay with it. We're not going to follow it through. They've basically said it's legally wrong and it's completely impractical, kind of reiterating a lot of what Google has said.
Well, Google's not wrong. I mean, on the one hand, though, let's bear in mind two little facts here. Number one, 1995 predates Google by quite a long time.
Yep.
And was written at a time when the web was largely unrecognizable from what it is today. And number two, Google has a lot of money and manpower to technically maybe police these sorts of takedown requests. But what about the little guys, the smaller search engines?
Exactly.
How do they deal with these if they're legally obliged to? They're often staffed by very few people.
Well, they don't. And I think also Europe was kind of saying nobody uses them anyway. So Google, we're going to focus on you, which is what they've done. But this committee, the Lords, which is a kind of EU subcommittee dealing with a ridiculous amount of things like education, sport, immigration, and also apparently European law relating to your digital rights. And they have said, yeah, it's completely unfair. Other search engines do not have the resource to implement it. Therefore, how can we be asking every search engine in the land to follow suit? So that was one of its main points. However, it went on to be, it just lambasted the entire thing. It said Google does not constitute a data controller, which is key to how they've interpreted this law. They're saying it's completely unfair to basically put them in a position of policing the web and judging content when it's only able to judge it on very vague terminology in the law, ambiguous and unhelpful criteria is what they called it. And that relates to the incomplete information or irrelevant information that the right to be forgotten says must be removed if Google is commanded to. Pretty damning statement. They basically said, this is a direct quote, "We do not believe that individuals should have a right to have links to accurate and lawfully available information about them removed simply because they do not like what is said."
You see, I would disagree with it.
Why?
I would disagree with this in some way.
What,
because
that comment?
I think Google is a data collector, and Google does police content on its site. It gets rid of links to things like child sex abuse images.
Yeah,
It will remove things under the DMCA, the Digital
Absolutely.
Millennium Copyright Act.
Yeah.
You can do a search. There are a lot of things that get removed from Google. It does do this.
And we've seen it in the past year with relation to kind of child abuse content that basically the government has said, you have to take charge of this, Google. And they always have done. They've always like voluntarily done this and helped the government. But in many cases, they've basically been told, do this or you're going to be in deep shiz and we're going to start creating laws to compel you to do this.
But I think as well, when they have had to remove that kind of content, they have been given very clear legal instructions about what content to remove.
That's also true.
Whereas in this situation, they've had to kind of interpret it, which is why they've ended up having to set up this advisory council, because they've obviously started the process already of going through requests and trying to work out which links that they should remove. But the instructions that they've been given are really ambiguous. So, I mean, kind of good on them, really, for setting up this council and, you know, sort of asking people for their input and that kind of thing. But, yeah, I mean, should it be their responsibility to decide exactly what this means? They should be given more guidance, I think.
Agree. I think a guideline is important. But I think that there is another issue at play here, which is the fact that this quote says that we do not believe that individuals should have a right to... basically to remove links that are accurate and lawfully available, but or words to that effect, if I hadn't have jumbled them quite so much. But the point is that time can make things inaccurate. The fact is, there might be information about somebody when something was true, and the fact that maybe a story, an article, or a follow-up piece, or what have you, was then added to say this is no longer true, it may well be but that the original one that's being ranked highly, or is the most publicly visible one, is the old one that actually then becomes untrue because, say, someone committed a very serious offence, they have a very unusual name, perhaps. I mean, my name's unusual. I'm the only Nate Langston in the world. If I was wrongly accused of killing somebody, for example, and then proved innocent, which is the case, and my top result was, you know, Nate Langston murders blah, 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 whatever, I think that would be very bad. You know, even if it was just a thing about accusation, I mean, it's highly damaging. But in those cases,
I'm sure they would put a comment if someone compelled them and said, you know, there's processes for things like that as well, and kind of a statute of limitations.
Yes, but I mean, this is the thing. What about then is the rule that it should be the websites that are hosting it originally? Because, you know, that can happen. You can lawyers will contact websites and send legal requests for takedowns saying to, and you'll get a big PDF spreadsheet or something, got a giant list of websites and URLs that say, you know, these are infringing and you're in here and you have to take this down because this case was proved or this person was cleared of charges or what have you. And it's very rare that you get to see them because it's usually for like local news websites and stuff like that. But it does happen, but they're not writing that to Google. They're writing it to the content publisher, and then the publisher has to decide whether or not to take it down, and then Google eventually updates it because it's spiders detect a change.
But isn't that why we have the word allegedly, and every article related to sensitive information or legal cases says allegedly, so that we're covering our backs for all time.
But this is the thing, is that if it's alleged and if that person might be severely damaged, if it's, you know, really harming them, I mean, yes, you're right. And this is why we're talking about interpretation and who is in control of this. And I know that's quite controversial, but I do believe that individuals should have the right to have information updated, maybe, let's say, or changed if it is that significantly damaging.
Yeah,
but Katie's also right that people then need to be given very specific information about what that where that information is, and precisely the actual Google search result itself, perhaps, as opposed to just you have to go and find this and remove them all. It's a combination, I think, of those two factors maybe that could make this a little bit more realistic as a proposition.
Well, they do give specific links, but this is actually where it gets really ridiculous, because apparently European regulators were complaining about how Google has been implementing it. And one of their complaints was that Google wasn't passing off enough information for then their national regulators to deal with all the complaints they're getting when Google rejects takedown requests. So they don't actually, like, nobody has the information. No one knows what information they need. Europe wants more information for their own regulators to decide what to do with this. But they're not telling Google in the first place what information they need to get. You know, there's no parameters. There's no, like, strict parameters.
So what this all comes down to, I think, what I've said, what the original proposition wants, what Katie said, what you've just said then, it all boils down to just accuracy of guidelines and protocol that needs to be put in place. And it does take experiments, things to go right, things to go wrong, sometimes to work out what the best protocol should be. But I do imagine that down the line, maybe not this year or even next year, but eventually this sort of a system probably will exist, but it'll be based off sufficiently researched and tested protocol.
The issue here is that the Lords and the UK government has basically said, we don't want this. We're going to create new regulations, and the wording is going to invalidate this law. That is what they're pushing for. So quite a few critics of what the Lords have said have come out and said, we need balance. Like you say, we need a more deliberated response to this, not just to say, let's throw it out, let's not do it at all, which is, you know, what they did with the drip surveillance law. Europe said, no, this goes against everybody's rights to everything. And the UK said, bah, let's just shove it through Parliament in a few days and it completely ignore your ruling.
Well, that was a lengthy discussion, but let us know what you think to this issue. podcast@wired.co.uk is where you can send your thoughts for us to read out and discuss on next week's show. Killer worms, Katie.
Yes.
That's the topic. Well, specifically killer worm sperm and its halting ability on cross-species mating.
Yes.
Bloody brilliant headline.
Nate, Leah, worm sperm, it is so much more dangerous than we ever knew.
Is it how I discovered that slime mold is more fascinating than we ever knew?
Yes, it's exactly like that.
Google slime mold, it's fascinating.
But more horrifying, right?
Much more horrifying. So basically, if most species attempt to crossbreed, nothing much happens. Or if they do manage it, then something interesting will kind of come out, like a liger or a mule or, you know, something like that. Very rarely does it actually end in disaster. But
that's why we've never had centaurs, isn't it?
Yes.
Sad
yeah,
news.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Just doesn't work.
Yeah. But if a worm attempts to mate with another worm that is a different species to the original worm, that worm can then die.
Wow.
But yes, it also dies
in a really horrific way.
In a really awful way.
So zoologists have found that the lifespan of female worms and their offspring can be drastically reduced if they attempt to mate with a male of a different species. And even those worms that survive are usually sterile afterwards. But what they did was they examined dying female worms that had mated with a male of a different species underneath a microscope. And they discovered that the sperm from the foreign male often have the ability to break through the sphincter of the female's uterus and into the ovaries themselves. And once they got to the ovaries, they would then fertilise all of the eggs prematurely, and they were then unable to develop. So this would basically destroy the ovaries of the female worm completely and would leave the female worm sterile.
That just adds insult to injury.
I know.
Aren't some worms, what is it? Hermaphrodites?
I'll come to that later.
Oh, okay. Slither on.
I know. When I started hearing about worm ovaries, I was like,
I know, you don't really
blown.
Think of worm ovaries, do you?
No, you don't think about it.
But
it's because it's ovary and above most people's concerns.
Oh,
seriously, slither on. This will keep coming if you don't carry on talking.
Okay, so basically, once the sperm are done, like, destroying the ovaries, what they then start to do is invade the rest of the female worm's body.
Oh, God.
And this can lead to tissue damage and eventually to death, which is a pretty horrific thought.
Yes.
That's a bit overkill. I mean, what's going to happen? Nate, I can
no,
see
no,
a
I know. I'm not going to say
he's,
it. I'm not going to say
he's
it. Carry
got a pun
on.
In him.
I'm not going to say it.
Okay.
I promise.
So you might be wondering, how does normal worm sperm turn into killer worm sperm?
That is one of the many things I was thinking just then.
Yes. Well, the answer lies in evolution.
Okay.
So basically, the divergence of sexual organ development in the different species means that worm sperm of the different species have different levels of aggression. So it's important to remember that worm sperm is quite feisty to begin with.
Is it?
It is, yeah, because often a female worm will mate with multiple males and then their sperm has to kind of fight it out to try and get to the eggs first in order to fertilise them. So they have an aggressive nature to begin with. But what happens is if the female is usually able to cope with the level of aggression of the sperm from worms of her own species, but if she mates with a worm species that has more aggressive sperm, then that sperm can be too much for her to cope with.
Not a thick enough sphincter.
Yes, exactly. So this is basically how this happens. And if she does mate with a worm of a different species, she's pretty doomed, basically.
So, but you mentioned this thing about the hermaphrodite
Yes.
Issue.
So it's also important to remember that several species of worms are hermaphrodites, and they will therefore kind of fertilise their own eggs with their own sperm. So
they should be safe.
Well, you'd think so, but because they can still mate with other worms.
So it's a battle of your sperm versus some other sperm.
And they're particularly susceptible to foreign males coming and mating with them.
You always hear horrendous procreation stories in nature where the male dies.
Well, there's that one where the male has to sever his penis, doesn't he, to
That's
plug the female, the spiders.
Exactly. Yeah. They plug it with their barb. They also sometimes stab the female, and that is how they introduce sperm, and then they break it off. So that hurts her. But in most cases, the man is self-sacrificing when he tries to get sperm.
Such is life, Liat. In about a year, 2015, driverless cars will be allowed on British roads.
Yes, Nate.
Not only will we be at threat from boy races, you won't even need the boy.
No.
Does that not inject a deal of fear into your fear sack?
Well, now it does, actually. I hadn't thought about boy races much. I'd thought about getaway vehicles.
Yes, that's also good work.
This actually might happen sooner than that, Nate. 6 months' time. January, according to Vince Cable.
That's next year.
Yeah, but you said a year away. 6 months, guys. Even more exciting.
Now, this is kind of like along the lines of what Google's been doing with its driverless cars, using different sensors to detect roads. I know they also did something to detect if cyclists pull out, because obviously that's a big problem in London, drivers versus cyclists.
Yeah, so they've kind of tested them in urban environments. They've tested, what is it? About 1 million kilometres Google's driverless cars have covered in California, because California has laws that enable that. UK does not.
Now, we've got some crazy roads.
Yeah, maybe that's why. America, it's just massive roads that go on for big stretches.
No roundabouts.
Yes, and no... Oh, my gosh.
Could you
driverless
imagine?
Cars might solve an awful lot of problems here.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people suck at driving. Anyway, so Vince Cable announced this, and it's been something that's been coming for ages. Last July, I think, they said it was going to be here last December. Never happened. Then they said it at the beginning of this year. Never happened. Now he's like, yes, civil servants are on it. So we're all safe. It's definitely going to go through. Civil servants are apparently being forced to write the regulatory framework by the end of this year that will enable it, which basically means the highway code will have this written in, hopefully, once they've busied away penning in all these new inclusions for what does one do with a car that does not need a driver.
I think it's really interesting, but there was no highway code, as far as I'm aware, when the very first motor car hit the street, right?
Yeah, but that was carnage. And also, they went at 10 miles an hour.
But it was still a radically new form of moving a person from A to B in a way that could potentially injure another human being.
Yeah, but
and
few
those,
people
a lot
have
of those,
them.
Those laws and regulations and things, I'm sure there were rules at the time, but it comes by experimenting. And we haven't currently got any electric, any driverless cars on our roads. And it's, I don't know, it just seems to me like, go on.
Well, this is how we're going to get them on the roads, Nate, because we can't even do proper research without having it kind of built into the UK's regulatory framework. So California, they've been doing it in private institutes. They've been doing it in universities, and private companies have been testing them on the roads. But in California, they just can roam free in the wild, with the proper controls.
So the idea here is we get regulatory approval, then we can start testing them on roads, and then the laws can be updated once we know what the problems might be and the solutions
exactly
are.
Yeah, we
I think that's a safe move.
Yeah. I remember hearing something as well, like they'll have to have manual like override.
Yeah, what if your driver's car goes nuts? They can be hacked, so says quite a lot of researchers, or they could potentially be hacked. So you have to have an override mechanism. I think European regulators said that a while ago, so we're all safe. Because there's lots of dangers. The FBI released a report last week, I think. Oh no, they hadn't released it. They had it leaked to The Guardian, and it basically said car chases are going to be super scary.
Well, thanks for that. Lizard sex satellites. specifically ones that got lost by Russia but then found again.
That's right.
In one fell swoop, I learned that such a thing as a lizard sex satellite existed, and then the wonderful excitement that it was lost, and then the relief that it wasn't about to start raining sex lizards because they found it.
Yes,
great,
well,
great news.
I don't know if any other countries are experimenting with sexy satellites, but Russia definitely is. And it's got one in particular called the Photon M4 satellite that was lost for 3 days last week. And it wasn't actually, like, they still had kind of, like, had contact with it, and they had, you know, but they just couldn't control it. And it was pretty bad, because it's not no ordinary run-of-the-mill satellite. There are, among other things, lizards on board. And, you know, it would be a terrible thing.
They were reproducing.
Well,
zero-G lizard 60 times.
They are not reproducing just yet.
How do we know?
Well, we know because they've managed to maintain control, and the lizards, there are five lizards on board this satellite, one male, four females, and
lucky
they've,
guy.
They've got them in this specially adapted cage or, you know, tank, and it's surrounded by cameras, so they kind of keep an eye on what's going on.
What
in
else
terms
are
of
they
like,
doing up there? Like, you're in space. You're a lizard.
What do you do?
Like, what do you do except...
have an orgy.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, they may well have, but they haven't actually, you know, they haven't completed the reproduction cycle, which ends in the birth of more lizards yet.
I see.
But...
they've been trying, not for want
of
trying.
Yeah, exactly. But what they're trying to do, the whole point of this, is they're trying to find out the effects of microgravity on not only lizards, but also plants and insects and how they reproduce. So when it comes to the lizards, what they're looking at is the effect on fertility, so can they reproduce, and also the structure and health of the lizard eggs when they arrive.
I see.
Eventually, hopefully, fingers crossed.
And now they managed to re-establish control over this satellite, so it is not any longer potentially going to rain lizards.
But they don't know exactly what caused the loss of control, but they've got it back. They're now considering sending it even further into space, which was the original plan, but they won't actually know what's wrong with it until it falls back to Earth, hopefully in one piece with the lizards. I don't know if the lizards will survive that.
Maybe probably there's not. A reptilian race that was like, we don't like what you're doing to our people.
I'm not sure. With only one male and four female lizards, that's never going to scale. Sorry about that pun. Wasn't sure if lizards had scales, but it was too funny not to at least try and get away with. But that's all for the news. For the first half of the show, we're going to take a very quick break. But hold on. Hold on through the break, because when we come back, we are going to jump into our topic of discussion this week, which is the experimentation on human beings by possibly your favourite websites.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do, since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. One segment for discussion this week. We've picked one of our lesser used titles for topics, but this is Sex Watch. In Sex Watch, we talk about anything. We could actually possibly put the lizard story in, anything to do with anything from sex to reproduction to love.
And the worms.
And the worms to human interaction, all these sorts of things. But this week, we are talking about experiments, because OkCupid had to come out and defend its experimentation on its members. Not only that, but it followed experimentation on humans, unwitting, uninformed, and potentially unhappy users of Facebook, which was trying to manipulate the emotions of its users by changing things about the news feed. And the news about Facebook came out after a former data scientist at Facebook told the Wall Street Journal that not only is there no review process for these sorts of things, but the team was at it all the time. And he's quoted as saying anyone on that team could run a test. They're always trying to alter people's behavior. Now, Facebook officially put it down to bad communication about what it was doing and understands apparently why people are upset and that they do care about privacy and letting their users have control. OkCupid, on the other hand, came out and defended itself quite, I wanted to say brazenly, but certainly quite honestly.
I think it was brazen because they didn't actually need to defend themselves. They just admitted to it.
Yeah.
And said, well, this is what we do.
A blog post came out from the OkCupid co-founder and president, Christian Rudder, who said, quote, OkCupid doesn't really know what it's doing. Very honest. Neither does any other website. It's not like people have been building these things for very long, or you can go and look up a blueprint or something. Most ideas are bad. Even good ideas could be better. Experiments are how you sort all this out. And what OkCupid was doing, apparently, amongst various things, was seeing if they could get people who are bad matches. It's a dating site, just in case you didn't know that. Bad matches to try and like each other. Hook them up by manipulating stuff. And OkCupid's actually a very data-focused company. They've got quite an interesting blog about dating statistics and stuff like that.
They're very proud of it.
Now, so these are two stories. These sorts of things do happen a lot. There is a lot of experimentation with users, and it's always usually anonymous, but when it comes to something like Facebook and it comes to things like dating and profiles and your emotions and your friends and potentially your loved ones, that's a little bit different from maybe experimenting with if you buy an MP3 player, maybe you'd also like to buy some horse hooves.
Yeah.
Because they've done some sort of weird profiling about when people buy hooves as well as MP3 players.
Exactly.
Not a big market, I imagine, but there are many jockeys out there who do need to listen to the Wired.co.uk podcast. Now, Leah, you wrote both of these stories.
Yes.
I'm sure you know that.
Yes.
But I wondered what your first thoughts were going through your head as you put together these reports.
Well, initially, I would say on the one hand, good news bears, as Liv would say, that they're kind of telling the public to think more about what they're doing with free services. Because we know that marketers, websites are always tweaking information to kind of modify what our behaviour. Well, marketers have been doing that forever, not just online. But they're kind of highlighting something that a lot of people don't really think too much about, except when you have this, like, Facebook's experimenting on you, horror. Facebook actually uses your personal data to sell things, horror. We don't think about it deeply enough. So on the one hand, it highlights that and makes you think about it. On the other hand, I was not totally on board with the way they went about it. It was quite kind of arrogant. When you're talking, like you say, about people's emotions and their lives and potentially their loves, I'm just not really sure that it's something you should be particularly that kind of brash about and quite, well, I don't know, like you say, brazen, quite proud of it.
Is this Facebook or OkCupid or both?
OkCupid, because Facebook kind of, well, they came out saying this is an academic study and that was, it was published in a journal. And that is something that has kind of risen a lot of questions about, well, if this is an academic experiment, why aren't you following the ethical codes of academia? Mm. And in the same way, OkCupid has kind of come out saying, of course, everyone does this. We do this all the time. We do these experiments. And they're using the terminology of, you know, an academic. And these experiments are not carried out with the same kind of careful procedures that a professional experimenter would do.
Well, you spoke to somebody to illustrate what that might be, didn't you?
Yeah, so I spoke to some people. I kind of looked up the regulations in the US and went and spoke to some people who do a similar thing in the UK, particularly for psychological experiments. And there are very, very detailed and lengthy guidelines about informed consent, and that informed consent should always be given wherever, you know, or always be obtained by participants wherever possible. And, you know, if there are studies that take place where the participants don't know exactly what's going on or why they're being, or even if they're being experimented on at all, that they should be then informed at the earliest possible point. Because there, you know, there probably are studies in psychology where, you know, if you tell people that they're being studied, they might respond differently, and so you don't necessarily get accurate results. So, you know, you can understand that, sort of fair enough. But then they say, you know, if that's happened, tell them afterwards. Like, yeah. Tell them at the earliest possible point. And, you know, it's this is just something that didn't happen at all.
And on top of that, of course, if you're doing a psychological experiment, even if they don't know what the experiment is and what's happening, presumably more often than not, they would have assessed, you know, their kind of emotional state or their vulnerability, which Facebook and OkCupid have no idea about their subjects' personal lives or, you know, what to them might be quite a serious thing. Like with Facebook, it was basically trying to make people unhappy or happy, which they deny. Mm. But it was seeing if happy posts will make people post things that are happy, if unhappy posts will make people, you know, post more negative things.
Yeah.
So you don't know if somebody is particularly vulnerable to having a lot of negative information thrown at them.
Exactly. And the guidelines, again, do specify that you should be particularly careful when dealing with vulnerable people, you know, children, whether you and also making sure that you've assessed that properly beforehand.
Yeah.
Well, we have a benefit of having somebody on the wired.co.uk writing team who's qualified in neuroscience. Chris Higgins, been on the podcast before. Welcome.
Hello again.
So you are a man of science. We were wondering what sort of a process should really go through for an experiment like this, or things with emotions and people's feelings.
Well, in both Facebook and OkCupid's case, these experiments, rather than just being changes in UI design, are closer to psychology experiments. And if we're going through a psychology experiment, we would usually have to clear it with an ethics board. So you would have to put your proposal through to an ethics committee, which would usually be part of the institute that's conducting the experiment, and they would decide whether or not it would be allowed through on ethical grounds. And what they'll try and decide is whether there is a maximum benefit coming out of a minimum harm. And technically what, I mean, OkCupid especially has done, has kind of reduced the trustworthiness of their algorithm, because now everyone's going to be looking at it and going, are they using me as a test?
Yeah.
Mm.
Look for love there?
You mentioned that they might have to work out whether something had the potential to cause harm. How exactly would you even do that?
Well, harm is defined in quite a few ways for an experiment like this. And in basic terms, it would be whether or not the participants were subjected to discomfort or stress or humiliation. And these things are especially relevant in research that involves sensitive topics.
I see.
I think sexual behaviour and dating is quite a sensitive topic to meddle around in.
Well, you can read Liat and Katie's reports and findings and opinions on this topic. Liat's written a opinion piece, didn't you, actually, about the Facebook one?
Or the OkCupid
one? But you can find all this, obviously, on wired.co.uk with searching OkCupid or Facebook or experiment or combinations thereof. And of course, let us know what you think to this issue, particularly if you're an OkCupid user. I imagine most people listening have accounts on Facebook. So we're interested if you're an OkCupid user or a user of any other dating site. How do you feel if the same thing had happened on whichever site you choose? Let us know, podcast@wired.co.uk. Of course, we will honour an anonymous reading next week. If you prefer, just let us know at the top of your email if you prefer to be read as anonymous. Okay, it's time for the feedback loop. Love this music. One of my favourite. We get so many emails about people asking, where's your music? Can I download it? Can I buy it? Well, no, it's chopped together specifically for this show. But by all means, just keep listening to the podcast every week because you'll find it there. The first one comes from Anchor, who says, hey, Wired podcast team. I just wanted to say I found your conversation last week, this was, on Hack North Korea very interesting. I come from Romania, which was under communist rule for a long time. And even though I was born after the revolution, I grew up with stories of the country under the communist regime. And even though the people rebelled at the time, they are now divided as to whether their life in democracy is better than the one they led under communism. While access to information and travel was restricted, many people remember being happy for various different reasons that would take too long to explain in this email. My point is, if people in North Korea are happy with the way their life is now, who are we to say it's wrong just because they are restricted in ways we are not? Now, Anchor has another couple of points there, which we're just having to chop for time, but I think that's a really, really good question, a very, very interesting observation, and really appreciate you writing in. I completely agree. I think everyone agreed when we saw this email. I suppose the fact is that we know that a lot of people aren't happy because they're in prison camps, and there are some pretty awful stories about poverty and about people having to sell goodness knows what to feed. And there are a lot of stories of people who've done some pretty atrocious things in the name of staying alive and keeping a family fed. Certainly that's not the case for everybody, and there are obviously extreme cases in either way, but certainly there are at least, I think, enough stories and evidence out there to suggest that there is a risk of quite a number of that population not being happy. But fantastic point, and really appreciate you writing in.
Ed has written in to say, hi ladies, it's the Scott living in Frankfurt. Very quick one. The most contentious issue of Google Glass is the camera. So why don't Google not do a version without, which would be smaller, cheaper, and not have all the privacy issues related to it?
Not as useful.
Yeah, but much. You can not outlawed.
How do you do proper augmented reality without a camera in the front?
You just don't, Nate. But it means you can go into cinemas.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's a fair point. It's a fair point, well made. Maybe they will at some point. It might be something they have to modify to release in certain markets, in the way that, say, Google Street View in Japan has to have cameras at a lower height in order to not take photographs over people's hedges and gates.
Interesting.
Yep. Anyway, speaking of Japan, John has written in, hi to you all. Love the podcast. We love you, John. I live in Japan and thought you'd be pleased to know about the lack of bias shown at fertility shrines, where tree limbs and boughs that have naturally grown into the shape of male and female genitalia are displayed with equal reverence. Keep up the great work. That's from John.
Wonderful.
Fab point.
I will Google image that immediately.
Thank you, John.
Alan has written in, and he's wondering about the recent government anti-piracy letters that they are supposedly sending out to people. He says, if my ISP send an allegation to me and I tell them I did not do it, I am innocent, honest, what will they do? Can you check with the ISPs? If they accept my claim that I did not do it, will they expunge my account of any claim?
No.
No, I don't think they will. But also, I don't think that they really do anything other than send these letters anyway.
No, because they can't prove who was using it in the household.
Yeah. No. So they'll send you the letters, but it doesn't. It probably won't have any effect on you.
So here's how it works. If you download something illegally, like, copyright, if you download something that is infringing copyright, and the industry that represents that copyright detects that it is your IP address that's doing it, and they trace it to your ISP, that ISP will send you up to 6 letters with gradually severely, with language rather that increases in severity about the threats, and you'll get those one for each time you are caught doing it. However, if you get 6, nothing else will happen. It's a very, very odd rule. You're basically fine. I wouldn't worry about it. Data protection does mean that records have to be stripped after, I think it's 2 years now. Mm. It might even be 6 months for some of the ISPs. But basically, you're fine, which is weird. Not saying we're condoning piracy, but as far as answering your question is concerned, and if you're not doing anything anyway, then the chances of you getting wrongly flagged 6 times is probably not that much of a risk anyway. So I would say unclench and stay happy. Victor has written in, says, hello, podcast gang at Wired. First of all, welcome back, Nate. Thank you very much. It's been a great podcast, but brilliant to hear your vocals resonate in the online ether once again. That's very nice to know. He says he's been listening for years, but has never written into the podcast before. So if you've listened for years and never written in, write in. In regards to the latest podcast, where amongst other things you discussed the Hack Career event in America, I have to agree with Olivia, where she mentioned that the information needs to come from within the country in order to make sure it does not get the stamp of propaganda from the outside world. It's a great comment, but I'd be interested to hear how you think this could be addressed. Personally, I think the smuggling of information through USB sticks and other means sound brilliant, but how restricted are other means of online communication through, for example, cloud storage services and the like? Could I send an invite to an open folder in a Dropbox account to all@northkorea.kp and it would be accessible? And what about proxies? Like many have worked around the ISPs blocking certain sites in the UK through the use of proxies, could this be done in North Korea as well? Victor, the answer is basically no to all of those things. The problem is that North Korea's internet is more like an intranet. So you only have access effectively to computers and servers hosted within North Korea. Those that have access to the outside internet are highly, highly restrictive and very unlikely to have things like Dropbox installed on them. And they would probably risk life and limb of them and their family if they were caught on those machines. So unfortunately, it does kind of rely on non-networked proliferation of information, at least at the moment, certainly. That's not to say that couldn't change in future, but at the moment, that's pretty much how it's going to be. So no Dropbox for North Koreans, I don't think, yet.
So we've got three more quick letters to read. Glad to hear of your return, Nate, says Michael.
You're welcome.
You asked for topic suggestions. I want to say goodbye to my 2006 iPod Nano, which I used for music and your lovely podcast. Any app recommendations for an Android smartphone that permits variable speed podcast playback and can play all the usual music files?
Yes, it's called Pocket Casts. It's the best podcast app in the world. I bought it, I use it, it's wonderful. Variable play speedback, plays loads of files. It syncs to cloud servers, so you can have it on multiple devices. It even syncs playback position if you have more than one device. It's brilliant. It costs, I don't know how much it costs, a couple of quid, I think. Pocket Casts, there you go. A plug. And Isaac has written, oh yes, this is it. In fact, Isaac is the name of the guy apparently who works at the Apple store who we mentioned last week when one of our team here went in to get an iPad fixed or something. And he asked when I was coming back and he heard last week and said, hello. Hi, Isaac.
Hi, Isaac. Hi.
Oh, he's,
well, he's only really interested in Nate.
360 and the podcast. 360 thing. It was very, very nice to hear from him. And we got a last one that we're going to get to very quickly here from Alex Liat.
Yes, he was also super happy to have Nate back. He said when he cut in front of Liv on last week's show, it brought a big grin to his face. And people on the tube that morning must have started worrying for their personal safety. Keep up the excellent work, he says. You guys always put out a slice of oral heaven each week.
Certainly do. Certainly try, rather. Well, you can get your email stuffed into our feedback loop and read out on next week's show. If you email podcast@wired.co.uk, we will have Olivia back next week. And don't forget the new issue of Wired with those surfboards designed after sea creatures and the education special, giant ATVs, two front-wheeled bikes and fashion tech and all that lovely stuff is on sale now on iPads and iPhones and tablets and newsstands and things like that. Do go out and check it out if you want to see some fantastic photographs, if nothing else. And we'll see you next week.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.